Hello, and welcome to Opus 3 of the Counterpoint Club with the Skyros Quartet. We are the hosts for this podcast.
I'm Sarah Pizzicami.
I'm Brandon Vance.
I'm Justin Curries.
And I'm Willie Braun. Just like Opus 1 and 2, this series will feature 5 episodes, each centered on an important theme or aspect of chamber music. The Counterpoint Club originated as a screen-free educational replacement offering for Tuned In 2020, our annual summer student chamber music festival. We see this season as a virtual replacement for another of our Chamber Music Madness programs, the Emerald City Chamber Music Organization, or ECHO, which provides weekly coachings to chamber ensembles at middle and high schools in the Seattle area. We, your hosts, are the Skyros Quartet, a Seattle-based string quartet. We also serve as the artistic directors for Chamber Music Madness, the parent organization for Tuned In, ECHO, and several other chamber music educational programs. The Counterpoint Club is our newest offering. In addition to the podcast itself, we also got a brand new website, www.thecounterpointclub.org, which features supplementary material for each episode in a corresponding blog post. And with that, I'll begin episode 1 of Opus 3, The Plan. This episode is all about creating structure through organization in a chamber ensemble. I gotta say, I think this is a really great topic. Personally, I feel like having organization and structure in my practice gives me so much more direction. Having a plan for what I want or need to get done in a practice session or rehearsal makes it feel like I'm getting so much more done. But it's more than that. I don't just feel like I'm getting more done, I actually do get more done. In today's episode, Justin will start with our first segment, exploring the histories of how well-known chamber ensembles got organized and started playing together. Next, Brandon will discuss techniques for organizing rehearsals and how you and your colleagues can best plan out the time you have together. We are thrilled to be joined by cellist Gregory Beaver in our guest interview. Greg was one of our most important Skyros Quartet mentors and spoke with Sarah and I about applying a really interesting organizational strategy that's commonly used in the business and tech world to ensemble rehearsals. And finally, we'll begin a new segment called a Skyros Chat, where two of your hosts share a discussion together. Today's chat will be between Brandon and Justin. Now here's Justin with today's history lesson.
Hi, and welcome to the history portion of today's episode. Today's episode is all about how a chamber ensemble functions from an organizational standpoint. A good place to start is how this ensemble comes to make decisions, with people each having strong and often different ideas of how things should go. For this, let's take a minute and focus in on string quartets. Over the years, the way a quartet operates and comes to decisions about rehearsal times, concert dress code, what pieces are performed, musical phrasing, and technical considerations, and many other things has evolved. In the beginning, the first violinist took on a leadership role 99.99% of the time. Think back to early quartets that were even named after the first violinist. Have no doubt that they made many of the decisions as the de facto leader of the ensemble. This has a direct connection to the orchestral tradition of the concertmaster being the leader of the orchestra. It made sense at first to adopt some of the conventions of what came before to something that was very new and had no traditions of its own at the time. In the 20th century, as string quartets became more and more of a full-time professional career path, a more democratic decision-making structure emerged. Just how long this evolution stalled is well documented in Arnold Steinhardt's book Indivisible by Four. In his book, he recounts that from the Schuppanzig Quartet in Beethoven's time to the Busch Quartet in the 1930s, you would have one strong personality surrounded by three acolytes. This is now an outdated stereotype, but something that probably every quartet musician has encountered. Even for Skyros, Sarah, our first violinist, has been referred to as our leader on occasion. In another anecdote from Indivisible by Four, Mr. Steinhardt recounts that after most performances, there would only be one beautiful bouquet of flowers presented, and it would go to him, as if he was the main voice and his partners were merely backup bands. In modern professional quartets, this stereotype lives on only outside of the quartet ensemble. It is now the rule, not the exception, to have four equal voices in every decision the quartet faces, usually in the form of a vote. There are as many organizational systems as there are quartets, but to be a successful ensemble, figuring out how to organize your tasks is essential. For Skyros, we use a modified Scrum technique. Scrum is a framework that helps teams work together and gets its name from rugby. Much like a sports team training for the big game, Scrum encourages teams to learn through experiences, self-organizing while working on a problem, and reflect on their wins and losses to continuously improve. In this system, unlike traditional development structures, Scrum teams don't have a structural hierarchy. Instead, they are self-managing and cross-functional. All team members are equally important and together have all the skills and knowledge necessary to deliver a working product. While Scrum is primarily used by software development teams, its principles and lessons can be applied to all kinds of teamwork, and it works well for Skyros. We have definitely come a long way from the Schuppanzigh Quartet's time when one person barked out orders. Now on to the technique portion of today's episode after a quick ad from one of our sponsors.
Is your regular planner getting you down? Because we've got the answer for you at Know Me Planners. There is nothing that you need to do but sit back and watch your planner plan just for you. Our pencil gnome consultants are on hand if you have any questions at all. We just know that Know Me Planners can change your life like it's changed ours. For a special limited time offer, you can get a self-writing pencil at no additional cost with your purchase of a Know Me Planner.
Hello, and welcome to the technique portion of today's podcast. Today I'll be going over some basic strategies that Skyros uses for successful rehearsals, concerts, and projects. There are two basic parameters: planning individual rehearsals or meetings, and planning how those individual rehearsals and meetings form an arc of a broader process leading up to a concert or final product. So, let's get started. An important thing to consider when coming up with a rehearsal schedule is consistency. If possible, try to find a consistent time of day that works for everyone, as well as a consistent number of rehearsals or meetings per week. For example, when preparing for a concert during non-COVID times, Skyros tries to make sure that we rehearse 3 times per week, starting at 10 a.m. Next, plan time for planning. It sounds a bit silly at first, but with a small ensemble that's performing regularly, it can be overwhelming just to keep track of all the balls that are in the air at any given time. Unless you have your own secretary, someone or some of the people in the group are going to have to respond to emails, decide whether or not to accept bids, and carve out group availability. When everyone is stressed out about unanswered emails or business-related issues, this can bleed over into rehearsals and distract from important musical work. As you probably have gathered by now, there's a good deal of secretarial work involved in being a successful freelance artist of any kind. It really depends on the group dynamics, but roles need to be assigned. Otherwise, emails don't get answered, or one person ends up with all the work, and this can easily breed resentment. It can be a fixed role, like John answers emails, for instance, or the assignments can rotate. Just like the actual rehearsal process, though, consistency is key here. Have a regular time carved out for business matters. In Skyros, we've found that a weekly business meeting really helps us stay on top of all the secretarial work, as well as job assignments. One more element of workflow and organization for teams is Scrum. Now, Scrum is an interesting word that's been around for a while. It's often associated with software development, but in a nutshell, it is a framework that can help teams work better together. In Skyros, we actually use a loose form of the Scrum framework for our workflow, whether it be planning and preparing for engagements and events, or creating podcasts, for instance. Without getting too bogged down with the details, the basic idea of Scrum starts with a backlog. Now, this backlog is just a set of prioritized to-do items that are assigned to each member of the small team. The team then sets a short time frame to create or prepare the overall product. This is usually about 2 or 4 weeks, and it's called a sprint goal. In Skyros, we use a combination of Slack and Trello apps to keep this dynamic to-do list organized. With Trello, there are actually cards for each task, and within that card, there are various tasks assigned to different members of the team, along with deadlines for each task. So it's really nice to have everything in one place like that. Now, the power of Scrum is really in its flexibility. The Scrum Master is the one who keeps track of all the moving balls and makes sure that the list is staying up to date. This can be done on a daily or weekly basis, though with a sprint goal of just 2 to 4 weeks, it's probably best to manage the list daily. Another important bit of wisdom in general is to come up with small, achievable deadlines that everyone agrees on. A concert is a natural deadline, of course, but in order to prepare for a concert or any timed release of creative work, small, achievable deadlines need to be implemented. The work can get done without these deadlines, but it's kind of like cramming for an exam the night before. It's way more stressful than it needs to be, and often the product suffers. For example, instead of saying, "We need to have Bartok Quartet No. 2 ready by our March 1st concert," we would say, "By next Monday, we're going to have the first movement ready for run-through. The following week, movement 2, etc." Next, make sure to plan in break times. When you spend a lot of time doing focused artistic work with certain people, it can get stressful. Even among the most laid-back, amicable people, personalities are liable to rub up against each other, and people are going to feel misunderstood, unheard, and maybe even resentful. Make time for some cookies and tea. Everybody will feel better, and you'll have a more productive rehearsal. There's no hard and fast rule about how often you should have breaks, but generally speaking, people should take a breather after maybe 1.5 hours of intense practice or rehearsal. The rehearsal arc. With a lot of orchestras, the players have just a few rehearsals to work up to a piece, and the conductor is primarily responsible for directing the organization of the rehearsal process. However, what's great about playing in a full-time quartet or band, when it's not COVID, that is the fact that we're able to really go deep and allow the piece to sit and simmer, as it were. It also allows for each person in the group to have their own voice heard in a more democratic way. This more egalitarian rehearsal process requires a lot more time, but we also think it yields richer results. In Opus 1 of the Counterpoint Club, we talked about some of Skyros' favorite rehearsal techniques. But one of the most important parts of our organizational philosophy is that musicality must come first in order of priority. The first questions we ask as a group are always ones like, what are the characters, or what is the destination of this musical phrase? So we like to start big and then narrow the focus as we go. Within rehearsals, we find that the hourglass approach is often a good one. But we also like to extend that hourglass approach to our overall schedule when preparing for a concert. For those of you who are just starting your journey with us on the Counterpoint Club, the hourglass approach to practicing is the idea that we start with a run-through to get the big picture, then assess and focus in on more detailed passage work. At the end, we try to apply things that we learned from the passage work on a final run-through. The hourglass approach is a really good general way to organize practice sessions and rehearsals, but when it comes to the arc of the overall rehearsal process, it can also be applied to that. The first rehearsal or two are usually big picture rehearsals, which often involve as much talking as they do playing. It's basically the four of us coming up with an individual and communal understanding of the music and its context. As we come up against various technical challenges such as ensemble, balance, intonation, etc., we start to focus in on those issues until they're resolved. Towards the end of the rehearsal process, we try to plan in at least three rehearsals that include run-throughs of the entire program that we'll be performing. Maybe there are still some things that need to be workshopped, but it's really important for the group not to get bogged down with details at this point, so that we feel rushed and unprepared for the concert. Disciplining ourselves to be ready for a run through at least three rehearsals before the concert is a good way to make sure that we all feel comfortable and have a successful, fulfilling performance for both ourselves and the audience. So in summary, today we talked about the organizational principles of consistency, planning in time for planning, assigning roles, scrum, planning break time, and the rehearsal arc. I hope this was helpful for you and maybe gave you some organizational ideas that you can implement with your own ensemble or team. Next up, it's quiz time, hosted by our very own Justin Curies.
Welcome to Opus 3 Quiz Time. Today, I, Justin Curies, will be leading the quartet through some interesting questions. And let me begin with our first question. So today's episode is about organizations, so I thought I'd kind of pick questions that are organizational in nature. So, the first question, who wrote the Haydn quartets? Start off with an easy one.
Wasn't that Mozart?
That's right.
Right, because they were dedicated to Haydn, his teacher.
That's correct. Very good. That's a little warm up.
That's almost a trick question, though.
You know? Almost a trick question. Yeah, yeah. Okay, great. I thought that would go fast, so I have some more. Okay, in what decade did Haydn publish, not compose, publish his first string quartets, Opus 1 and Opus 2?
Well, that's specific.
Yeah. Oh, they're his first ones. So that's when did he publish his first quartet?
Based on the last question, I'm guessing it wasn't the same decade that they are written in.
That's true. And I forgot this is also a multiple choice.
Oh.
So, oops.
Oh, perfect. Okay, that's helpful.
Mistake by me. Here we go.
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah. No, I'll do the whole thing again. Okay,
Brandon agrees.
In what decade did Haydn publish his first string quartets, Opus 1 and Opus 2? 1750, 1760s, or 1770s?
I think it's the 1760s.
I'm going to say 70s just for...
I was going to say 70s too, just for fun.
Yeah, exactly. Because I don't know.
Because I don't know enough.
Sarah is correct. It is the 1760s. And he most likely wrote the first ones in the 1750s.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Wrote them in the
50s. Hanging out with his buddy at court.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So my last question is, who wrote the most string quartets in history?
Let me just think about that for 5 minutes.
Not a multiple choice question.
Okay, Haydn wrote like 72 quartets, right?
I'm gonna guess Boccherini.
That's a good guess, but it might have been more quintets though.
I don't know. He wrote a lot of stuff.
He did. Also, Villa-Lobos wrote quite a few quartets. I don't think it was anywhere near in the 70s.
I thought he had like 17.
Yeah, okay. I'm going to go for...
And Shostakovich also in the teens. Beethoven in the teens.
But none of them are close to Haydn.
No, but Telemann wrote a ton of everything, but I don't think it was string quartets, though?
Not string quartets, though.
No.
I think it was too early for that.
Yeah.
Wasn't quite doing as much of that.
I don't think so.
I'm going to say either Haydn or maybe Boccherini, but I'm going to go with Haydn.
I don't know.
I'll give you guys a hint. This is probably the worst hint in history because it's going to be the least helpful hint in history. It's not someone I ever heard of before.
So I'd
be very surprised if you ever heard of this person either. Good hint from Justin, but there you go. Okay. So if you don't know
basically
who it is,
you're wrong.
It's someone you've never heard of. How about that?
Okay.
Or probably
one of those hack composers. Do you remember reading about those hack composers that just wrote a lot of like terrible music to get published and make money off of it?
It's possible. I've never heard any of their quartets, so I can't judge, but I'm guessing that's probably true.
I like how full-time string quartet musicians can't think of this person who wrote the most string quartets. They must be totally horrible to quartets.
Right.
So, okay, go ahead.
And you at home listening can go look at them up and maybe give us a little comment on what you think of these person's string quartets.
All right,
it's Paul Ranitzky.
Wow.
How many quartets?
He wrote 73 quartets.
Just being
And if people at home want to look that up, I'll spell the last name. It's W-R-A-N-I-T-Z-K-Y.
Okay.
Ranitzky. Okay, got it. Okay.
Paul Ranitzky. In second place is Ignis Pleyel with 70.
That was one of my
guesses. That was at 69 for Haydn.
And then Haydn at 68.
Okay.
Okay.
I guess, but if you include that, what is that one big work that has like 7 movements in it? Isn't it more? Or is that in the 68 quartet?
That's getting too minutia for this
anyway,
question.
Okay. I don't know.
Published quartets is what I'm...
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, sure. Well,
all right. That was great. A little learning, and I'm curious to if anybody comments on what they think of Paul Ranitzky's string quartets.
I think I got to go find out what I think.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
All right, thank you guys for quiz time.
In today's episode, Sarah Pizzichemi and myself, Willie Braun, are joined by Gregory Beaver. Greg was the cellist of the Chiaro String Quartet for 18 years. Skyros was really fortunate to have the opportunity to study with Greg and his Chiaro Quartet colleagues for 3 years during our doctoral work. They were incredible mentors to us and had a huge impact on the way we as Skyros rehearse, perform, educate, inform, and interact with audiences of all ages. Personally, Greg was my teacher for those 3 years as well, and I am so thrilled that he could join us today to talk about organization in quartet life.
Hi, Greg. Great to see you. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Yeah. So we're here today to talk on this episode about organization. And we wanted to have you join us because when we were working with you during our residency with the Chiaro Quartet, we saw how much really great work you did with organizing all these massive projects that Chiaro was undertaking during those years we studied with you. Can you tell us a little bit about the process that you and your colleagues used to memorize the Bartok quartet cycle and how you went about organizing so many months of work?
Gosh, I'm getting PTSD just with the question. No, I'm Bartok wrote 6 string quartets, and each one of them is kind of a universe of challenges, both technically and musically, because of what he was interested in while he was composing, sort of bringing in music from traditional recordings he had made of traditional music all over Europe and Northern Africa, and also his sort of 20th century take on those things, as music was getting more complicated in the early 20th century. And so we decided to take on a massive challenge of memorizing all of the quartets. And this was at a time when we had started memorizing a few other pieces. The Brahms quartets was the first project we took on, and then a few other pieces by Mozart and so on. And we decided that it was time to do something that would sort of put our stamp as, here's something that we believe in as a quartet. And so we decided that it would be kind of crazy and amazing if we could memorize all of the Bartok quartets and perform them in a single event of some kind. So we started this planning 2 years before we actually did it. And we started out really just sort of thinking about what that would mean, what would we need to do in order to memorize all of these pieces. There are 6 of them, as I said. So we started out by thinking, well, how many times would we want to play the cycle with music before we started playing it without, and how would we make that transition? Then we started to figure out what that transition would look like, how many performances would we have one of the quartets memorized, and then how many with 2, and work our way up. And then, before we do all of them in one event, how many times would we perform them as a separate concert? So we could do 3 on one concert, 3 on the other, with space in between where we could refresh the memory. And we landed at a number of, you know, we could probably do this in 2 years based on those things. So we were looking at, based on previous experience, 10 public performances of a piece before we felt really comfortable as a quartet from memory. I should say 10 performances where we tried to play it without music. So we added up a number of concerts. We looked at our season and we talked to our manager about how we could book those things. We looked at the series we didn't have to ask permission to book, like our series at University of Nebraska. And also we were doing a residency at Harvard, so we thought we would include that. And so that's how we got started with the idea.
It was such an amazing experience to get to witness, just hearing. I think I only ever got to hear 2 or 3 in one performance. I don't think I got to hear all 6 in one go in Nebraska. But even just a couple of them in a row was an incredible experience to get to see you guys performing these massively difficult and complex pieces from memory.
It was equally exhilarating to do it as soon as we got over that hump of terror.
Yeah, that's definitely how I felt. We, Chiara and Greg here, encourage us to try it as well. And I remember doing that, and it was exactly how you say, terrifying, but also kind of exhilarating. I don't know if I loved it like for a long-term thing for me because of the terror, but it was actually, I felt like I knew the repertoire so much better than I would have even like doing a concerto or something. Because I don't know, the colleague experience of having your colleagues there for you, and if you feel like you can actually trust them in the performance, then it really transformed it. So that made a big difference for me.
Yeah, that at its best, I think, was the amazing thing about memorizing. It forced us to be more reliant on each other and more trusting of each other in a way that I think string quartet rehearsal doesn't naturally tend towards because of the pressures of time and actually it's a limited amount of time that you get to express verbally what you would like to try. There's so little time to do that in a quartet rehearsal if you're functioning normally or healthily. If you're functioning healthily, really everyone gets a very small amount of time to speak. There's more time playing. And so you can find that ideas will fester and get stuck in your head if you're not careful, or not even careful, if you're not really dealing with the health of yourself and of the group. And playing from memory, there's really, you look at this thing and you see people struggling and it's like, I feel that. That pain is me right now. And so you have aural patience. You can hear it. You know, when it's not there, it sounds unbelievably terrible. And you just have to do it again until you get there. That was a big part of the process for us, is it allowed us to go deeper into the music making through not talking, which being intellectuals, we'd like to talk.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Yeah.
Well, we had another question for you about organization. What advice do you have for chamber ensembles when they're organizing their rehearsals?
That's a great question. There's a lot of easy, sort of low-hanging fruit ways of answering that. The answer to that question that interests me the most has to do with the purpose of organizing in the first place. So when organization works for a group, it's because the group is really aligned individually and as a team on what's important and on why it's important. And that goes not just to the question of what's important for the group, but also for each individual member. There's always a tension in a group of any kind between the needs of the individuals in the group and the perceived needs of the group from both inside and outside of the group. I found that in the Chiara Quartet, there were a lot of demands from everyone we interacted with that were competing with each other. So the demands of the university, the demands of our, and I maybe demands is too strong of a word, but sort of the things that excited the university, the things that excited our manager, things that excited each individual presenter that we played for in concert series, as well as things like what would interest the person we're about to interview with in the press for an upcoming concert or a major project we're working on. Those things all compete with one another, and it's very easy to lose your way into giving into the strong excitement of others and finding a way that you have a core that everyone in the group has agreed upon that energizes each individual person as well as the group as a whole. And those things do overlap in weird ways in string quartet. I don't know. There's something really amazing when all four people have agreed on something sort of implicitly as well as explicitly, is that the energy is shared. That's when you start finding like, hey, I don't play this well, but I am right now because of the way the energy works. That kind of magic happens. So getting back to the question of organization, the thing that I think is most important for being organized as a quartet in your rehearsals has to do with each member of the group finding their center first, outside, finding the areas where you need therapy, finding the areas where you need family and friends support, things that we take for granted in a certain sense that, like, yeah, of course you're going to do that. But because of those pressures and those of the excitements that others have, I think it's much harder to do that and find that in a string quartet than it is in a job that has a kind of stability to it. I think the most wonderful thing about string quartet is that it's unstable in many ways, that you have a kind of unexpected sense of what the future will be almost all the time. But it's scary when you really sit down and you look at your electric bill, or when you sit down and you think about looking at your calendar in the future and wondering, will there be this opportunity to do these exciting things we want to do? Those pressures can cause you to organize your personal life in a way that you're not as healthy in service of what you perceive to be what's important for the group. And I think there's a natural tension there. You will go back and forth in everything that you do in life between being healthy and not so healthy temporarily not so healthy to support that dream. So part of the organization of rehearsals is, what do you need? And if you decide to do something that is against that, you need to be very explicit about how that works for you individually and how long you guess that you'd be able to do it, and communicate that to the group. You know, if it's like, we have this major event coming up and we feel like someone says that we should practice 5 hours for a couple of weeks, per day. You should look at that and say, what does that mean I'm sacrificing? And how long is too long? And after we do that, how are we going to recover if it's too much? If the whole group is like, only 5 hours? Great. That's a different kind of a question. You know, some groups rehearse a lot more and are comfortable with it. But in terms of sustainability, if members in the group have any other interest outside of the string quartet, you need to find time for that for long-term sustainability. If that's not in place, you can't organize. Arguments will come in as soon as you get tired, and inefficiency will take over and everyone will be frustrated. But that's the first thing that I think I was never really told, and it was not obvious to the Chiara Quartet for probably 10 years how important that was. We knew that we had to take time off. It was not about that. It's about if you don't talk about imbalance, personal imbalance explicitly as to how the group fuels that, it's very difficult to organize rehearsals. Once you have that in place, then we can talk about how you go forward. And, you know, this is not a, like, get it in place and then you're done. It's like, once you've started doing that, you will always have to revisit it. And a big part of what the process I'm about to go into that worked for the Chiara Quartet was that we had regular scheduled times when we would sit down and talk about how is this working for you and how is this working for us. With that, it allowed us to really find kind of cathartic changes every 2 weeks where we would be like, wow, this thing we just talked about, everyone felt the same way. I thought I was alone in feeling a little stressed about this thing. I'm being very vague because it really wasn't like fix just this thing or that thing. It was every 2 weeks there was something that we hadn't anticipated that came up that affected us all, and having a safe place to talk about it really helped to open things up.
I can see how this, I hope like our listeners can tell how influential it was for us to spend so much time working with the Chiara Quartet, almost like apprentices to the Chiara Quartet, because it's really helped us manage these things even earlier than probably we would have self-discovered it. And it probably involved, avoided a few implosions within the group that could have been pretty catastrophic. So
that's really great to hear. The specifics of the process that we found helped us the most. I think I'm just going to say one more time, this specific process is not the answer. What I just said is the answer. The process only helps you organize it, because I've seen this specific process used by many others unsuccessfully. So that's the biggest caveat, is that without that safety and that individual commitment to health, you cannot use this process effectively. And the process that we used in the Chiara Quartet is something borrowed from software engineering called Scrum, which, if I'm being honest, I think could not be a worse possible name for this thing, because it has very few intuitive associations with pretty much anyone unless you like rugby. Scrum is a process that's pretty old. It was first noticed in 1992 and named in 1992 by a paper that studied several companies, not in software, across industries. So you had Toyota and a few other manufacturers, and I think one software company. They'd studied these companies to see what it was that had allowed their teams to deliver things that they were planning to make ahead of schedule with higher quality. The commonalities that they found were codified in this paper is like, here's the things that they did. And then over time, this was sort of developed further until around the turn of the millennium, software engineers discovered it, and it became the standard process, at least in name, used across the industry. And that, at least in name, goes back to the first point I made, which is most companies do not care about or invest in the emotional safety and health of their employees. And so they can't implement Scrum properly because of that. Back to our original plot, I've always been a tinkerer of computers. I discovered this process at a real low point for the Chiara Quartet. We had just performed at the Library of Congress, which I think some of you are thinking, gosh, that doesn't sound like a low point. We performed at the Library of Congress on their collection of Stradivari instruments and had some just blistering arguments in the preparation for that performance. This was right before the holiday break. We decided we would think about what we could do to make things work better and then reconvene after the holidays and talk about it. Over those holidays, I discovered at a dinner with my uncle that he was a certified Scrum trainer. I didn't know what that meant at the time, but I'd heard of Scrum just mentioned in passing by some of the acquaintances I have in software. So I asked him which book I should read, and he's like, how about mine? When I started reading the book, I discovered in the first four pages that it wasn't about software at all. It was about this process, Scrum. And he described the exact tensions that we've been having in the quartet. And I was kind of blown away. So I read the whole thing cover to cover that night. It's a very fast read. It took about 4 hours. And then I wrote up sort of a proposal of how that could look for the Chiara Quartet. I presented it to the group and they were like, all right, this is interesting. So we'll try it out. And the three of us will take the lead since it was your proposal. This is one of the, we were always thinking about balance even before this came to process. The thing that I think the best way to describe it is it's kind of like a cycle, the way Scrum works for us. You make a plan and then you inspect at the end of a short time period, how did the plan work out? And you adapt. You make another plan, then you inspect it and you adapt. And everything else comes from that cycle. So when we were organizing, we also had ceremonies, or that's what they call it in Scrum, but I would call them meetings, were part of the process. They were not like faculty meetings or other meetings we might be used to, in that they each had a very specific purpose and they happened in this 2 week cycle. They happened at specific moments. So we had one meeting every morning for 15 minutes where we stood up and sort of checked in on the things that we had done outside of rehearsal, you know, emails, that kind of stuff, and then planned what we were going to do in the rest of the day. There was one meeting that only happened at the beginning of the cycle where we decided which of the things on our to-do list we were going to do over those next 2 weeks. With one meeting towards the middle of the cycle where we would take our to-do list and just look at all the things and come to an understanding, a shared understanding of what they were. And we would take things that we thought, oh, this might be kind of big, and split it up into smaller pieces. We had another meeting where we would take that to-do list and we would each agree on how long we thought things would take to do. And that's how we would get our list of those things. What was kind of interesting about this is we would assign them arbitrary numbers based on comparing them to each other. You know, this one's bigger than that one. And at the end, we'd have this list of piles of things organized by how long we thought they would take. Then we'd give these numbers to the piles and use those numbers. We'd look at when we were in the inspect part of our cycle right at the end. We'd look to see, okay, we thought we were able to do this many numbers if we add up all those things. And we were actually able to do this. So that averaged out to this many numbers per hour. That's what we had to do because our rehearsal schedule varied so much. And then we would say, okay, based on that, we can probably take in, you know, 60 arbitrary numbers of these things for the next 2 week cycle. And that means we can do down to this line of our to-do list. Made it very fast to accept. And then we would have a little debate sometimes about at the bottom of that list. Ooh, I think that thing that's below the cut is actually more important. Oh, I forgot probably a really important detail. To-do list is always organized from most important to least important. And that shuffles as you go through and learn more about what you're going to be doing. You might find something moves down to the bottom of the list that was near the top, or something that was down, this is more common, down at the bottom. You're like, oh, actually, we got to learn that sooner than we thought. So we'll pull that up. That was the only way we were able to organize well enough to do the Bartok cycle, because we, you know, we're like, okay, we need to do these things a year and a half from now. What does that look like? When do we have to start learning it? How long does it take to memorize the first minute of Bartok 6 compared to the last minute of Bartok 5? Well, the last minute of Bartok 5 takes more time. What about first versus second in Bartok 6? Okay, we split those up. And we're like, okay, so the way we've got these here, the last minute of Bartok 5 is in the 21 column. That means 8. So we've got 1, 2, 3, 5, 8. So Fibonacci series, and then 13 and 21. Anything above 8, we said that's going to take more than the 2 week cycle. So we got to split it up somehow. So we'd take the last one and be like, okay, we're going to learn it with music under tempo and perform it. That's something we can do in 2 weeks. Then the next week, we're going to learn it up to tempo and perform it. Next cycle, I mean. And then after that, we're going to, you know, memorize it and perform it. So it's 6 weeks of time, essentially, split up into three chunks where we have something that we can actually do for people at the end of it. That's like a small window into the process.
Wow. Thank you for all of that. I think people will find it very helpful and interesting. And it's definitely something to research more, I think, and go and find out how it could be useful to you. Because I know it's one of those things you can almost apply to anything in your life and get results with the right mindset.
We tried it with our children. And it worked really well, except that we got really tired of organizing two scrums in our life. So we gave up on the children.
So too good.
We will link your uncle's book on our blog post for this episode. So if you head there, you'll find that book that Greg just mentioned.
Great.
Yes. Willie does have a copy, thankfully, yep, as well.
I've got a bunch of articles can look up on my blog as well at gregorybeaver.com about how to apply this to chamber music depending on the commitment level of the group.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we'll definitely also be linking your blog post about it and your website. So for anything Greg related, check out our blog that we will link everything to, or go straight to Greg's website.
Well, Greg, this has been such a pleasure to speak with you today. This was such a fantastic interview, and we were so glad to have you join us on the Counterpoint Club.
Yeah, you're welcome anytime.
Oh, thank you, Willie and Sarah. And thanks to the Counterpoint Club in abstract. Seeing what you are doing, really, really wonderful. Always been proud of the work you've done, and to have shared those few years where we sort of stumbled along together trying to figure out what to do. It's really great to see how you've leapt forward from that into your own new universe of possibility.
Thank you again, Greg. We were so delighted to have you join us today. Head to thecounterpointclub.org, where you will find links to all the many things Greg talked about, like his uncle's book about Scrum, in the blog post for this episode. And stay tuned for the extended version of this interview that will come out after Opus 3 is complete as part of our Encore interview series. We talked to Greg about life as a musicianship, musicianship as life, books, composition, and much more. Thanks, Greg!
Have you spent hundreds of hours preparing a concerto, only to freeze up as soon as you get in front of an audience? Do you have a nasty case of the bow shakes? If anxiety is keeping you from performing at your peak, you may consider consulting a Zen gnome. These gnomes are experts at breathing exercises and centering techniques. They can slow your heart rate and help you direct your energy and focus into music making, not nerves. Your one-week free trial of Zen Gnomes comes with two complimentary Zen Gnome soundtracks, including Calming Sea Sounds and Croaking Frogs at Dusk. Zen Gnomes may also aid in soothing short tempers and alleviating general irritability. Zen Gnomes are ineffective against irritable bowel syndrome. If you have symptoms, including bowel pain, diarrhea, or constipation, please contact a physician. Hey everyone, and welcome to Chats with Skyros. Today it's going to be me, Brandon, and Justin. We are the inner voices of the Skyros Quartet. So, starting out, I'm going to ask you a question, Justin. What do you feel is your role as a violist in the quartet? What's the most important aspect of your role?
It's a great question, and it's one that I think about a lot, and I'm sure you do too, as my fellow inner voice. For me, it's been interesting because I've played in every role except for the cello. I kind of have an idea of each one, first, second, and viola. And for me, the viola really sits kind of at the fork in the road, in a way. You know, it's the lower end, close to the cello, in voicing. And so I feel like I kind of act as a conduit a lot between the textures, between the voices. So, you know, if a composer is going to write something high and he's going to something low, oftentimes it runs through us.
Right.
Or the viola. As far as maybe we're doing the texture, maybe we're kind of in the middle. And yeah, so it kind of, I feel like I act as kind of a conduit, as a pathway. And then in that same aspect, I feel like I'm kind of a motor rhythmically.
So an active conduit.
Yes, an active conduit. Yes, very active. It's the road is a little bit. It's not so much a road, but maybe like an electrified mag rail.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So there's some activity, but
we're moving the train down the rails.
But you're still carrying a big load.
Yes, that train is a big load, and it's, you know, yeah, first violin, second violin, they, you know, their parts are important. But so we, I, so yeah, I feel like, you know, I'm moving that along rhythmically and harmonically. You know, a lot of the inner harmonies are decided by what the violist does, what the second violin does, you know. So we have a lot of the harmonic movement and rhythmic movement. And then I think the other thing is color. You know, the viola specifically as a difference in the inner voice section between the first and between the second violin and the viola. You know, you have two violins. You know, violins are different makers and different ages and stuff like that, so they have a slightly different, but they're both the same instrument. So as the viola in the inner voice, I feel like it's my role to provide a different color. And that is, you know, somewhat based on what instrument you play. But I think that thinking that way, you know, you can add that kind of, you can control that a little bit with your technique and with what you're thinking about, what music you're playing, what is appropriate at the time for that. So I think there's a lot of that in it too. And then it's fun to play a solo now and then and bring something different. And that goes along with the color. So.
Awesome. Well, I think I'm going to answer the same question here myself. So for me, as a obviously as an inner voice, there's a lot of overlap between our functions, you know, both rhythmically and texturally. So there's the texture element that I'm sort of a, I think of myself almost, you said, use the word conduit or, you know, kind of like active conduit, that very much the same, similar kind of role in that way. Also like kind of an ambassador. That's another way I like to think of it. I'm sort of a rhythmic ambassador. So it's all about listening to all the parts. And to a certain degree, isn't that what all of us do in the quartet, right? We're all trying to be listening to every single voice as much as possible. But yeah, so I think ambassador, texture, a big part of second violin is making sure you're not stomping on other people's textures. It's easy to just kind of play. You have to have a mentality that you are always making sure that the balance is right. So I think balance is a huge factor in playing second violin. If you're, you know, because you've got the viola doing, you know, their range, and sometimes there's overlapping ranges, and so you have to ask yourself the kind of questions like, who has the line? Those kind of, who has the actual most important, the Hauptstimme, you know, the important line or whatever at any given moment.
We're a big part of the layer cake.
We're a big part of the middle section. And that's a lot of flavor. There's a lot of flavor in the middle. A lot of spices. You get, especially on a spice cake.
You're the sponge layer.
Spongy, spongy. All right. Well, that was super fun. And thanks for joining us for Chats with Skyros.
Ugh, don't you just hate it when you're in rehearsal and no one listens to your ideas? I mean, come on, obviously your ideas are the best, right? In episode 2 of Opus 3 of the Counterpoint Club, we explore compromise so that ideas from everyone in your ensemble get equal respect. Thank you for listening to the Counterpoint Club today. This has been Opus 3, Episode 1, The Plan. A special thank you to Gregory Beaver for such a fantastic and insightful interview today. If you enjoyed today's episode, we would be grateful if you would leave a review, write a comment or question on our blog post for today's episode, or say hi to us on Instagram, where you will also see visuals from all of the great sponsors and products you hear advertised in each episode.
The Counterpoint Club is brought to you by the nonprofit organization Chamber Music Madness. The hosts are Sarah Pizzicami, Brandon Vance, Justin Curries, and Willie Braun of the Skyros Quartet. Our producer is Sharon Wong, and our audio engineer is Hunter Rath. The theme music for the Counterpoint Club was composed by Brandon Vance and performed by the Skyros Quartet. The managing director for Chamber Music Madness is Virginia Wright. Thank you to our Chamber Music Madness sponsors, 4Culture, ACMP Associated Chamber Music Players, the Seattle Office of Arts and Culture, and Arts Fund. You can find the Counterpoint Club on all platforms for podcasts. Visit our website, thecounterpointclub.org, for additional resources.